From Colombo, Malaysia, this is Season Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this month's podcast of the CSEN Center. My name is Ole Rummel and I am the Director of Macroeconomics and Monetary Policy Management at the CSEN Center. I'm joined today by my colleague Len Tasky, who will introduce himself in a minute. Before I do that, let me start by introducing today's topic, which is on cybersecurity. I'd like to introduce the topic by mentioning a little private anecdote, which is that I've recently been able to ascertain that my online information has been hacked on at least three different occasions. Now, I'm still unsure what to do about this and if I should do anything about this. And the question is, if this happens to me as an individual, imagine this happening to a firm or an institution in the economy at large. So this leads us to talk about the topic of cybersecurity and cybercrime. The reason we're bringing this up today is that for many central banks, financial stability is a vital common resource. And indeed, financial stability is part of the remit of many central banks. Now, this idea of financial stability being a common resource also applies to financial cybersecurity. Now, what do I mean by this? I understand financial cybersecurity as the protection of financial information and communication technologies and their associated network from failures and attacks. This is especially pertinent for financial institutions, and I'm always reminded of the quip attributed to Willie Sutton, one of the most famous bank robbers in the US, when he was asked, you know, why was he robbing banks? He allegedly said, "I rob banks because that's where the money is." The modern day equivalent to banks would be the financial system, in particular payments and settlement systems. So Glenn and I will be talking today about the issues of cybersecurity and cyber risks having to do with payment systems, settlement systems, and the financial system in general, because today or nowadays, that's where the money is. And we will probably conclude that we will probably share a view that was put forward about a year ago by a joint paper by the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation and Oliver Wyman, two respected private sector firms, who concluded that it's a question of when, not if, a large-scale cyber attack succeeds against the financial system. Having set the scene, I'll now turn you over to my colleague, Glenn.
Okay, thanks, Ole. My name is Glenn Tasky, and I'm the director of the Financial Supervision and Financial Stability Payments and Settlements Systems Workstream here at CSEN. Ole, I think you were absolutely right when you said we have to talk about cyber risk as kind of moving up from the individual person to the individual institution to the whole payment system and then up to the entire financial system. As you know, our podcasts are kind of, they're available to everybody, but they're kind of directed at a financial sector audience, whether they be central banks or commercial banks or other types of financial institutions. But we all know that we are working in this space, but we're also consumers. And so we have both a professional and a personal interest in this general topic of cyber risk and cybersecurity. And I think you were absolutely right in pointing out that it is a threat to financial stability. And you talked about we don't know when a major cyber attack will occur. We only know that it will occur at some time in the future. And it's kind of like what we say about financial crises in general. We don't know when the next financial crisis will start. We don't know what its origins will be. But we do know that sometime in the future, we probably will have another financial crisis. And some commentators have said, fairly casually, but with some solid evidence to back it up, that perhaps cyber risk will be the source of the next financial crisis. So we look at it from the broadest perspective of threats to financial stability, and then we work down to the level of systems and then individual institutions, and finally down to individuals. So I think the purpose of this podcast is to kind of help the listeners to organize their thoughts around what must seem like an incredibly baffling and complex and rather scary area. Most of us are not cybersecurity experts or IT experts. Ole and I certainly are not experts in this area. But there is a lot even for non-experts to understand. And that's the hope of this podcast, is that we can put some framework, give a structure to how we should think about these things.
Great. Thanks, Glenn, for fleshing out some of the issues. Let me just add sort of a few thoughts of my own in terms of, you talked about a hierarchy or a structure. So when I think of a financial system nowadays, or modern day financial systems, I think they've become much more vulnerable to a cyber attack than they used to be in what I might call the olden days. In the sense, we've seen a lot of consolidation, we've seen a lot of economies of scale and scope. So the financial markets have become much more concentrated, and we have seen the creation or the development or the evolution of financial market utilities in a sense, comparable to utilities in the private sector. So these utilities are the obvious places to attack should a cyber attack occur. And at the hub of these financial market utilities or FMUs are the payment systems. And I found it interesting that, for example, the Bank of England does a systemic risk survey every year. And for the past couple of years, the cyber attack is cited as the top source of systemic risk in financial markets. Returning to, as you said, the kind of structure, I think one of the issues of how we get from a cyber attack to financial stability is, I think, through three channels. Now, these three channels are not new. I took them from the Office of Financial Research in the U.S. And the first one is just a lack of substitutability. If one of the hubs in the system is compromised, be it a large custodian or a clearinghouse or another one of these utilities, is there another entity that can step up and take the place of the firm that's been compromised? The second channel is a lack of confidence, which comes from the system being attacked. Can we trust the continued functioning of the system? And I think the third point is, or the third channel, is a loss of data integrity. And I was just wondering whether that would be a useful way of structuring these our thoughts, or whether you have a different hierarchy.
I think that's a very useful way of looking at the system. You mentioned the existence of a large number of financial market utilities and financial market infrastructures. And in a sense, that can be viewed as the plumbing of the financial system. And we all know, because we're all households and we all have plumbing issues to deal with from time to time, that major blockage in any part of that system can cause very uncomfortable and damaging effects throughout the entire system. And the same thing is true in the financial sector. Through these financial market utilities, and you've rightly mentioned custodial banks, you've mentioned payment and settlement systems, we could add to that markets for securities and markets for derivatives, organized exchanges for these financial assets. You could add securities settlement, you could add trade repositories. All of these are companies and organizations that most of us don't even think about on a daily basis because we don't interact with them, we don't interface with them. Most of us don't even know the names of some of these large companies. I mean, how many of our listeners have ever heard of the Continuous Linked Settlement Bank? Well, it turns out it's a big organization in the United States that has relationships with most of the major financial institutions around the world. People are starting to know more about the messaging system SWIFT because of some incidents that have happened with SWIFT in different countries.
Which is the Society for Worldwide...
Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Transactions or something. You're right. We don't think about these because they're kind of like utilities. They're always there. They don't enter our consciousness as long as they're working properly until they don't. And then, you know, we definitely have a problem. And I think that problem can spread rapidly to a loss of consumer confidence. And remember that the entire financial sector is built on confidence. The whole sector is vastly interrelated. And we have banks and other financial institutions depositing in each other, lending to each other, borrowing from each other, making wholesale payments amongst themselves, and utilizing these financial market utilities as intermediaries. And we saw during the financial crisis how key the element of trust really was. In that case, it wasn't an issue of cyber risk or, you know, malfunctioning of the payment system. It was a lack of trust in large markets for the securities that were being used as collateral for interbank borrowings and all of those good things. And when that trust melted away, the market for these securities melted away. The markets froze up and then we had liquidity crises. Well, this is really something which we have to keep in mind when we're talking about cyber risk and we're talking about the financial sector as a whole. And finally, you mentioned the issue of data integrity. And probably all of us, or most of us who are listening to the podcast, have had some sort of notification from some company that our data have been compromised. Our personal data have been compromised by retailer credit card hackings, by hotel registration hackings, by the hacking of personal credit data on tens of millions of Americans in the Equifax hack, which occurred back in 2017. And we could go on and on. In fact, the issue of protecting our data is so important, and it's required such a prominent place in our consciousness for many reasons, you know, not only because of cyber risk, but also the misuse of our personal data, such as what was done by Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and all of those other firms connected to manipulating voter opinions in elections, and we could just go on and on. But data integrity risk is so important that it was identified as one of the five big risks of information and communication technology by the European Banking Authority, which was one of the first international organizations to come up with a categorization or a taxonomy of what we call ICT risks, or risks to the information and communication technology in general. So I think the EBA taxonomy is a pretty good one, because cyber risk is an important part of that taxonomy, but it's not the only one. When we're dealing with the complications of information communication technology, we have the big issue of availability and continuity risk. Sometimes systems just crash. Nobody has gotten in there and tried to make it crash. It's just some bug that makes it go down. How fast can it get back up again so that the individuals have access to their bank accounts, and so that other banks can receive payments from the affected bank? Sometimes payment systems have gone down. That's the type of availability and continuity risk we're talking about.
On a more mundane level, I mean, I don't know whether you recall a major U.S. airline having problems when their reservation system goes down, in the sense of stranding millions of passengers all over the world and having to scramble to get them back without any sort of ICT system.
Absolutely. I mean, airlines have been working with ICT systems since the 1970s to track their reservations. I don't think that any of them have the capability to go back to any sort of a manual system when you look at the large volume of transactions in any given day. In addition to these availability and continuity risks, we have something called change risk. And change risk is happening because the pressure of competition is causing banks and other financial institutions to want to improve their IT infrastructure on a regular basis, to keep up with all of the advancements and to lower costs and to make it more functional and speedier. But every time they change, when they bring in a new system or they bring in a new application, you have the risk that it'll go down. You have data integrity risk, which we've talked about before. The data may simply disappear, it may become damaged, or may become tampered with. We have a really big source of risk, outsourcing risk. Financial institutions outsource a lot of their activities these days to third parties. And the question for the financial institution is, do these third parties have the same high standards of ICT risk management as the bank itself? This is something that regulators are looking very closely at, particularly because banks are, and even central banks are considering and are in fact doing, outsourcing a lot of their data applications, their software systems, and their data management to the cloud. And that creates outsourcing risk for the system, which can become very concentrated, because these cloud providers are not that many, and the number of firms using these cloud providers are numbered in the tens of thousands. And then, of course, the big problem of cyber risk. In the EBA taxonomy, this is called ICT security risk, but it really is cyber risk. You know, and cyber risk we could probably narrowly define as all of the bad things that are happen that are caused intentionally by someone, you know, by some bad actor.
Now, I'm thinking about a situation where we've seen a lot of consolidation in the banking sector. And So, you know, banks buying up other banks, inheriting the sort of IT systems of the takeover bank, and having to integrate two different or even more than two different systems. Where would that fall into this taxonomy? Sorry, is that a problem? And where would that fall into this taxonomy?
That's a good question, Ollie, because we are seeing it. I know in the CSEN courses that we run in financial stability and supervision, I always mention that the number of banks, I ask it sort of as a trivia question. I ask the group, how many banks do we have in the United States? And we get all kinds of estimates. You know, I don't allow them to look it up on their smartphones. Well, the answer is we have about 5,400 banks in the United States. But when I started in banking supervision 30 years ago, we had 14,000 banks. And so we've had a great amount of consolidation over the last 30 years. And I think the same thing is true in many other countries around the world. And you asked a very good question. How does it fit in the EBA's taxonomy? And I think the consolidation ticks off every point in the EBA's taxonomy: availability and continuity risk. Continuity when the merged bank takes over the IT system of the target bank. Change risk: the employees and the other and even the depositors and the borrowers of the target of the acquisition in a consolidation, they will face change risk because, you know, who knows, maybe their account data could disappear in the transition. Data integrity risk, outsourcing risk, I think is definitely present because the two banks are not likely to have used the same outsourcers. And these cyber criminals, you know, who knows, they may actually be looking at the banks, you know, that are planning on consolidating, thinking that things will be a little bit uncertain for a while, and maybe this is the time to start lurking in one or the other systems before everything gets all done and dusted. So I think it takes it ticks off all the boxes, I think, in the taxonomy. And that's a really good question. And simply just creating a very, very large financial institution creates all kinds of access points. And that's happening in general. We have so many access points into the financial sector that we didn't really have in the past. Mm. You know, now we have the familiar, what's by now very familiar, activity of online banking. We have ATMs, you know, which were described by Paul Volcker as the most meaningful technological advancement in banking in his lifetime. Paul Volcker doesn't seem to think much of fintech and some of the more recent advancements. We have open APIs, which allow banks to give third parties access to customer data with the customer's consent, of course. And then we simply have, going back down to the most basic level at any financial institution, we have employees' devices. Employees are accessing, in maybe some banks where cyber hygiene is not up to the mark, we may have employees accessing the bank systems with their own devices. We may have them downloading lots of different attachments without checking the origins. We may have them putting pen drives in their laptops and introducing malicious software into the system that way. So we not only have this consolidation, and we have banks growing, but this is happening at a time when we are also seeing these major technological advancements in the system and creating all sorts of new access points.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Let me ask you two more questions. The first one having to do with how we should respond to the threat of cyber crime or how we should ensure cyber security, in the sense that, you know, it's one of these things where the probability of it occurring is relatively low for each individual institution. So you would think that there's no real incentive for each institution to ensure or prevent or try to prevent a cybercrime, yet when it occurs, it may have ramifications for the system as a whole. So who should step in to ensure cybersecurity? Should it be at the level of the individual institution, where, as I said, the probability is very low, or should it be at the government level to try to prevent cybercrime from happening?
Well, I think that, you know, you brought up a very important issue. And it relates back, you know, I think quite naturally to your initial observation, which is that the financial system is vastly interconnected. And we have to focus on the topic of cyber risk at all the levels, at the level of the individual institution, at the level of the bankers associations or the self-regulating bodies that exist in many countries to oversee the financial sector, the formal regulatory agencies in each jurisdiction, and the formal regulatory agencies, they do have to play their part. Because if you just left it to the individual institution, you wouldn't take into account these externalities or these spillover effects from one financial institution to another. And then you have to jump out of the financial sector into the level of the national government. And I think that this sort of hierarchy is starting to be recognized. One of the issues that comes up again and again in CSEN's annual courses, which by the way are among the most popular courses here at CSEN, ICT Risks in Banks. These courses are always oversubscribed. And one of the most popular questions that arises at these seminars by bank examiners and off-site and on-site analysts who work for regulatory agencies is, hey, do we all have to learn to become IT experts? You know, we have to learn so much, credit risk, market risk, operational risk. Do we all have to learn how to be IT experts so we can understand IT risk, in particular cyber risk? And the answer to that question is no, you don't. Regulatory authorities, whether they're central banks or separate regulatory financial sector authorities like you have in many countries, their role is not to become all-encompassing ICT risk management experts themselves or IT technicians themselves. But what they must do is they must insist on minimum standards of ICT risk management and cyber risk management. And these can get these can become fairly detailed. And the examiners do have to recruit some IT experts for your specialized teams. But in a way, it's kind of similar or analogous to the process that regulatory authorities went through when banks started to get heavily involved in the capital markets, buying and selling and holding complex securities. That's when they had to start hiring, the regulatory authorities had to start hiring capital markets experts, you know, people who were trained and they knew how to analyze the risks and the profitability of these securities for the banks. And they became embedded in these teams, and gradually the information began to become diffused through the organization. The problem is with IT risk and cyber risk, when we're talking about central banks and regulatory authorities, is that an issue of basically a shortage of manpower everywhere, and an inability of central banks and other regulatory authorities to pay the salaries that are required. I read one interesting piece of information, an estimate that there was going to be a shortage throughout the world of 1.8 million IT security professionals by 2022. Now that's a very big shortfall, and it creates upward pressure on salaries and everything else. And then we had to have to realize too that central banks have to communicate with their national, you could call them perhaps the national cybersecurity strategies of the countries as a whole. The jurisdictions, almost every jurisdiction is developing a national cyber risk management or cybersecurity strategy. And what the financial sector regulators have to do is make sure that that fits in to the national strategy. So it's very much a hierarchical, but it has to be addressed at every level kind of a problem. Maybe one way of summarizing it is, what do we have to do? Do we have to make IT specialists and particularly cyber risk specialists into bank examiners? Or do we have to take bank examiners and turn them into cyber risk specialists? And I think probably the answer is, you know, we don't have to do either. We just have to put them on the same teams, and we have to make sure that there's meeting of the minds, and there'll be a little bit of overlap there. Mm.
This is a really fascinating topic. Let me ask, I said I would only ask two questions, I lied. Let me ask the part B, which is that obviously there is a stigma attached to having been the target of a cyber attack. And I always wonder how much information we actually have, i.e. do firms actually tell us that they have been a victim of a cyber attack? And what do we do to get around the issue of non-reporting of a potential cyber attack?
Well, that's a huge issue in financial services industry, as I think in many other industries. Banks are very much prone to secrecy, and they're used to keeping a lot of information closely held, partly because of laws. They can't share, you know, their customer information with other banks, but partly because of custom. You know, they don't want other banks to gain a competitive advantage over them. So it is a huge issue. And when we were considering organizing and carrying out a policy summit in cyber risk, which we are doing, by the way, CSEN is going to be holding a policy summit on central bank leadership in combating cyber risk here in Kuala Lumpur on the 13th and 14th of June this year, about 2.5 months from now. And when we were drawing up the agenda for the Cyber Risk Policy Summit, we put the topic of information sharing in a large time block on the agenda. And the reason for that is it always came up at our courses and conferences where we address the issue of cyber risk. I think what you see is, first of all, organized mechanisms are being set up to share cyber risk and information. We have cyber risk information being shared among the banks through organizations such as FSISAC and others. we have mandatory sharing of cyber risk events from the banks to their regulatory authorities. What we don't have in the system now is we don't have a lot of cybersecurity information sharing across central banks. And this is going to be a major topic of discussion at the policy summit because, as you know, we will have senior regulators present as well as people from the financial services industry, from the IT industry, and so forth. And so the question is, how do you get these networks going? You mentioned the reluctance to share information, and I think that's a major problem. Now, banks will very easily share with each other cybersecurity threat intelligence that they receive. They don't have a problem sharing the threats, but they do have a problem sharing with each other the incidences, the cyber risk events. And that is because of that old problem that bankers, you know, don't want to open their hearts out to other bankers. It's a very competitive industry. So I think that when the information goes to the regulators, now we don't even know, maybe not all the information is going to the regulators either, particularly if it's not the kind of cyber risk event that is interrupting customer service in any way. I think that this issue is still evolving throughout the world and mechanisms are being set up. One of the things that makes cyber risk so baffling to many people is because you have a plethora of acronyms. And if you go to a cyber risk or cybersecurity conference, you're going to be hearing people speak in acronyms, you know, such as CCERT, CBEST, ENISA, AISACA, and it just goes on and on. But I think it stems from the fact that so many organizations are being set up to deliver information, to share information, to do research and analysis in the financial sector, that at least people recognize that it's a huge problem. I don't think they've come up with all the solutions yet.
I'm glad you mentioned the policy summit. Can you give us just a sort of a taster of the different themes or sessions that that will be explored on those 2 days?
Absolutely. As we usually do with our policy summits, the first day is devoted exclusively to senior regulators from our region, the CSEN stakeholder space or the Asia Pacific region. And on that first day, we are going to have an overview of cybersecurity and financial stability, which is a perfect way to start. You know, you have to get everybody's attention that, yes, you know, this is a risk to financial stability, just as, you know, asset price bubbles and indebtedness of households and things like that. And then we quickly get back down into the nitty-gritty. We will talk about information sharing, and that occupies a big part of the agenda. And then we'll talk about central bank oversight of the cybersecurity preparedness or cybersecurity resilience of the regulated institutions. And I think it'll be very exciting because some of the central banks and monetary authorities in Asia have really come out to the forefront in establishing risk management evaluation guidelines for their institutions and systems of information sharing, systems of working with the financial institutions to improve the human resources that are available. And that kind of will transition into the second day. The second day, as we always do, is open to a wider audience, everyone who wants to come from the first day. Plus, we open it up to financial institutions, IT professionals, academics, policymakers, and the general public. And the human element of cybersecurity kind of takes center stage on the second day. And there we'll talk about the skills shortage. There we'll talk about behavioral aspects within banks or maybe any kind of organization that allow individuals to become sloppy in cyber hygiene, or maybe to give some individuals the sense that I want to do something bad. You know, how do you produce a bad actor? Because some cybersecurity threats do come from the inside. We're going to talk about the emerging threats to the financial sector and the all-important topic of cybercrime. Next, we're going to talk about financial technology and non-traditional providers of financial services and how that relates to cyber vulnerability. Now we have the e-commerce giants getting involved in provision of financial services. And does that increase vulnerabilities? And we're going to close out with kind of an interesting discussion that a lot of people may not have thought about in the issue of cyber risk management, and that's cyber risk insurance. You can buy insurance against a cyber risk event, but that market is kind of in its embryonic stage, and we will have an interesting industry representative as well as a banker to discuss that issue. So I think we're going to cover a wide range of topics, but I think we're covering probably the most important topics at this stage. It won't be technical. You know, people don't have to be IT experts in order to learn and in order to be exposed to some of these very important concepts.
Great. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you for talking to me today, and thank you for having this discussion. As Glenn said, the second day of the policy summit is open to everyone. So we would love to see as many of our listeners as possible. So thank you again for listening in this month, and stay tuned for our next podcast that's coming in April. So Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ollie.
Thank you for listening. And as I said, tune in again next month.